This is All In. I'm Miriam So. Today, we're talking about efforts to unionize in Indiana, and we'll be focusing on a union push in Kokomo from bus drivers, custodians, and other non-teacher school staff. It's based on reporting from Jeannie Lindsay, education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We're joined now by one of the people Jeannie talked to for her recent feature story about this push. Heather Jackson is a bus driver in Kokomo. Welcome to the program, Heather.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, what is it like to be a bus driver in Kokomo right now?
Well, right now it's chaotic, to be honest. We have been, over the past several years, you know, just getting shorter and shorter with drivers. And I know that's really an issue, not just here in Kokomo, it's really countrywide. But, you know, with being less and less drivers that we have, people, you know, drivers leaving to go to other school systems, you know, our buses are just getting packed even fuller and fuller because we don't have enough drivers to split them up more. So it's getting a little crazy, a little chaotic, and even hotter on the buses because we've got so many bodies in there.
And has it changed in recent years? Obviously, the pandemic has an effect, but have you seen things improving for bus drivers, or has it gotten worse?
I'd probably say it's gotten a little worse over the last few years.
And what makes it worse?
Just not having enough staff. You know, we've got the biggest school system around here in our county, and, you know, we've got little drivers to haul a lot of kids. And, you know, that just makes the kids more frustrated and cranky on the buses because they're crowded in there, especially right now when it's so hot and the buses don't have air conditioning. And then we got, you know, parents that are rightfully upset, you know, wondering where their kids' bus is, and they're standing out there at the bus stops. And, you know, with cranky kids on the bus, you sometimes get more fights and stuff like that. So, you know, the parents are getting frustrated and stuff just as well as we are.
And that's got to be challenging also, not only for drivers, but bus aides. Do you have enough on your routes to keep up with what's going on?
Definitely not. And, you know, with being shorter on drivers this year, there were some changes that I'm assuming was part of, you know, losing even more drivers this year that, you know, we used to have so many special needs buses. We do still have some that are like basically more for wheelchair kids, but even those buses have, you know, got general education kids on it. And there's been special needs kids, you know, just spread out through the other buses. I've got some kids on my bus that, you know, their paperwork says they need an aide, but we don't always have enough aides to go around on all the buses.
And what's the problem if there aren't enough aides? Just for our listeners to understand who might think like, well, it's just a drive. You're going from what point A to point B. It can't be that difficult.
Well, you know, if you got one that's depending on what their disabilities are, you know, if they like to move around on the bus, you know, we do have, I do have seat belts on my buses as well as the other buses if the students require those. But, you know, if they don't know how to get out of them, you know, we got to pull over as quickly as we can if we have to deal with that. Or, you know, with the other kids being on the buses, you know, they may pick on the special needs kids if they're, you know, around them. Or so, you know, if we have an aide on the bus, I mean, they can address those situations while we're trying to keep an eye on the road and get the kids to school and, you know, back home in the afternoons.
So in terms of the unionizing and things that are being done right now, what are some of those steps that you're doing to try to fix what's going on?
Well, I mean, we've been addressing the board and trying to speak with them and, you know, find out why they wouldn't recognize us as a union. And we've collected signatures from the community on a petition. You know, we're still gathering signatures there, and we plan to present those to the board and hoping, you know, they see the community support, you know, that maybe that'll help change their mind, or at least, you know, have them to, you know, be more honest and open and tell us, you know, why they decided not to recognize us.
Is there anything that sets working in Kokomo apart from other cities that you've noticed?
Not that I've noticed. I know that, you know, all school systems and bus drivers have their issues. You know, I've born and raised here. So my girls go to Kokomo school. So, you know, I've had offers to go to other county schools, but, you know, I've been at Kokomo for, you know, almost 13 years and my kids go there. So it's kind of hard for me to say, I'm going to give up and just go to another county school. So I stick around, but it's getting tough.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's pretty tough. And with trying to push for this union, what compelled you? Was there like a point when you were like, that's it, I'm all in with this?
Well, you know, it just losing more and more drivers, and we had to do something. And, you know, I'm not a big public speaker. I didn't take speech class in high school because I don't like getting up there, and I didn't have to have it to graduate. But, you know, it was like we needed somebody to step up and no one else was. So I thought, well, I'll do it. I'll be brave. No one else will brave up. I'm sure other people were the same way. They don't like to get up and talk in front of people. So, but you know, it just, we needed something to start moving, to start happening. So I just decided, well, I guess I'll step up and I'll do it.
Well, I'm sure you're taking that step probably enabled other people to feel comfortable to take a step as well. Have you heard anything about other workers throughout this process that are supportive of this?
Well, I know we have the majority of our drivers and the aides, and like I, you know, the custodial and maintenance departments have also stepped up and wanted to join us. I know I'd been contacted a while back by someone who was a paraprofessional. I don't know that they haven't all joined with us yet, but I think, you know, more and more people probably will, you know, when we do get this push and they do finally see, okay, you know, we'll recognize you, let's work together.
I mean, it sounds like people are coming together and you have some community support. Have you faced any opposition at all?
From the community and that, no. You know, the community and that's been real supportive. The parents, you know, that are at the bus stops when I pick up their kids, they've been real supportive and, you know, helpful and understanding with, you know, buses being crowded and the issues I have on my bus with some kids. But, you know, there's been two board members that they voted yes for us, and the rest of them, you know, just voted no. And, you know, really haven't, you know, we've tried to talk to them, tried to contact them, email, you know, and they just keep saying it's a legal issue, which, you know, we don't, you know, help us to understand that because, you know, like we said, the teachers have a union. So why can't we, you know, what's the difference that, you know, you'll recognize that they have a union, but you won't recognize us.
Do you think any of them would ever come out on a bus ride, for example, to see what's going on and come up with some remedies?
You know, I have no idea if they would. I would love if they would, because, you know, we can tell people what goes on, but unless you get out of your office and come and really be in it, you'll never really know.
Well, what have you heard from other workers throughout this process? Is everyone in agreement about what they want for the outcome?
Yeah, I believe that they are. You know, it's been a long haul, you know, as far as, you know, not really getting a raise for many years. You know, we finally did. During this effort, they did finally give us a raise and gave us our 26 pays back, which helps us, you know, get paid through the summer. So we're not, you know, without, you know, 2 months without pay or trying to find a job that'll hire us just for a couple months. They gave the bus drivers and the mechanics a raise, but they did not give the aides a raise. And they really haven't addressed the maintenance and custodial yet. So, you know, we've gotten a couple things that we were working towards, but, you know, I really would like some of the focus, you know, to help the aides and the maintenance custodial now too.
Right. I mean, it seems kind of disheartening for folks to see their other coworkers getting raises and they're not getting anything.
Yeah. And we have, like, especially the aides, I don't know how many drivers we have at this point that are not considered full-time. But, you know, like we have aides that work full time, but they did not get like the different bonuses that we'll get. Like we got, I don't know if you want to call it a bonus. They had a COVID appreciation stipend that they gave us over the summer that they announced. But, you know, like our aides didn't get that because they're not considered full time. I forget the term that they always use, board certified, I think, employee, which basically means you're full time, I think. But they did not get that because they're not board certified. So I think that's something, you know, they're working full-time hours. Right. So they should get this too. You know, they worked through the pandemic when we came back and the schools opened. You know, they should have gotten that too. That's things like that that needs to be fair across the board.
And you think being able to unionize would be able to get that fairness?
I think that it would help a lot. I think that would give us a bigger voice and, you know, better backing to do the things that we need to do. You know, I spoke at the board meeting and told them, you know, no one knows how to do our job better than we do. You know, they sit in their offices and they do their job. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know how to do their job because that's not our job. But we know our job. So it's like, let us speak and let you know what's going on and give you some ideas so you know what would help the situation. But as of yet, they haven't sat down with us to do any of that. But
And that's what I was going to ask you is when you spoke to the school board, was there any response at all to what you brought up to them?
No. When they have let us speak at the school board, you have 3 minutes to speak. There's not any discussion, no questions after. And they time you. Your 3 minutes is up, you're done. So there was no discussion, no questions after that. They just let you say what you felt you wanted to say, and that was it.
Are you hopeful?
There's been no response otherwise.
Are you hopeful there will be a response or any change coming up?
I hope so. I hope they see that we're not giving up. We're not backing down. We really feel strongly about this and that there needs to be some changes and things happening so that we can attract drivers, that we can keep the drivers that we have, because we desperately need it. And aides, we need them.
And are you seeing anything changing at all from the efforts that you've made so far, or are you just kind of still waiting to see what's going to happen?
Like I said, the only changes that have come along, they did give us the raise and our 26 pays back. And they said that they were giving us an extra hour or extra half hour a day, which would give us a little extra money. But we were technically already getting that extra half hour a day anyway, because we clock in 15 minutes before we leave to do our routes in the morning and then 15 more minutes in the afternoon so that, we could fuel our buses and do that kind of stuff. So that was already an extra half an hour a day that we were already getting. So really that was just talk, I guess. So if they really are going to give that to us, because I drive about 6 hours and I already get that extra half an hour. So, if they're really going to give us an extra half an hour, then they'd bump it up to paying us 7 hours a day instead of 6.5. But at least we got to keep that extra half an hour.
Right. And so what is next now? What are your plans moving forward?
Well, like I said, we're going to continue going to the board meetings, continue try to speak at the board meetings, and we plan on gathering all the petitions and presenting them this month, September 13th, at the next board meeting. And then we'll see what goes from there and if that gets us anywhere and changes anything. And if not, we'll start thinking of our new next steps.
Thank you so much for joining us. Heather Jackson is a bus driver in Kokomo and part of an ongoing push to unionize with other non-teacher school staff. Coming up after the break, it's the Friday Recap, where we revisit conversations we had over the last week. And we will hear from an author of a new book that makes a connection between 90s hip-hop and the origins of reality TV. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobel. We're talking today about American culture in the late 80s and 1990s, particularly the emergence of raw, authentic rap music and the early days of reality television. We're joined by the author of an upcoming book on that very topic. Eric Harvey is an Indiana native who's now an associate professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. Eric, I want to ask you if you can give us a little bit of historical context. You can go back to the early 70s when rap music and hip hop culture started forming. Can you give us a little background on what that looked like?
Right. So if you look back at this moment, this was sort of the peak of the Black Power movement. When you think of the term soul, this was a moment when this idea was sort of congealing in Black communities and in popular culture together. And, this was, we all know the end of the 60s was a very, very heated time in terms of American politics and American cultural politics. And, so you had the assassination of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Then you had the kind of, around that same time, you had the Watts uprising and similar uprisings around the country. And, Black popular music was, during the 60s, you had Motown and Stax, and you had a lot of kind of crossover Black popular music superstars. And a lot of these folks, Marvin Gaye, Isaac Hayes, Curtis Mayfield, Aretha Franklin, and so on, Nina Simone, started incorporating kind of social commentary into their music. And so you get things like What's Going On and Superfly and albums like this. And At the same time, sort of a little bit more on the fringes, you had artists like Gil Scott-Heron out of New York City, who was a poet who started kind of setting some of this poetry to kind of very sparse production and eventually more jazz-leaning production. Gil Scott-Heron, who we know is responsible for the great phrase, the revolution will not be televised. And at the same time, you had the Watts Prophets, you had the Last Poets. A lot of these groups were really doing sort of oral poetry sort of to a beat and really laying the groundwork and talking about content-wise, like, what does it take? What will it take for African-Americans, for Black Americans to really kind of reach the status that they deserve in American society? It looks like the 60s have failed. What's next? What can we do? And so music sort of became a platform for that. And this is right around the same time in the Bronx where, you know, DJs like Kool Herc were throwing their first block parties. You know, Kool Herc was not an expressly political guy. He was a DJ. But the roots of hip hop were kind of congealing there as well. And so really by the end of the 1970s, you had the full foundation, the full framework of what we would later call hip hop.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke a bit about gangster rap and how people were confusing it, or at least the media was labeling it gangster rap. Is there a difference, or was that just the media term?
So it's interesting, right? So NWA, they both embraced the moniker and they kept it at an arm's distance. So, you know, NWA had a song called Gangsta, right? And this was a single that they released and they referred to themselves in their song called as a gang called We Know the Rest. And so they did that because, I mean, this plays into a lengthy history of rock and roll rebellion and popular music as sort of an outsider medium. And to be sure, NWA were total outsiders at the time that they broke through. This was not born in the center of the music industry. They were soon there, but they did it of their own volition. But the heart and soul behind NWA, for my money, is Ice Cube. Ice Cube, I think, is one of the most underrated, even though everybody knows his name today, I think he's one of the most underappreciated rappers to ever do it. And he was the brains, really, behind NWA. And he's the one who comes out and says, you know, it's about more than sort of the vulgar street stuff. This is he referred to hip-hop as a network of information. Which I think is a really interesting way of thinking about it. You know, this is how for rappers, he said, you know, rappers like Ice Cube, he says, oh, this is how I learn about what's going on with people like me in Houston through the Ghetto Boys. This is what I learn about what's going on with folks like me in New York, in Long Island, or in New York from Public Enemy and Eric B. and Rakim, rappers like that. And so Ice Cube kind of was doing with rap by merging entertainment and information. He was really kind of leading hip hop along with Chuck D and Ice-T. He was leading hip hop in the same direction that journalism itself was going, which was this merger of entertainment and information.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to note that, I mean, for folks who are listening, who may not remember these days, there was no cell phone and internet at this time. This seems like the most ingenious way to sort of have communication across the country.
Yeah, I feel like it, you know, when Chuck D said rap is Black America's TV station, right? And he said that in 1988. If he would have said that in 2008, you know, it would have been rap is, you know, Black America's social media, et cetera. But at the time, I think television was really this this medium that had a powerful hold on the imagination in terms of what it could accomplish in bringing America together and presenting them information and kind of reaching a mass audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. We're speaking with Eric Harvey, an Indiana native who's now an associate professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan, who has an upcoming book about American culture in the late 80s and 90s when it comes to rap and reality television. Eric, when we talk about gangster rap or folks that wanted to label it as such, what was the music usually about?
Well, that's a great question. It's about a lot of stuff. And so there's the content that really sort of angered a lot of people and worried a lot of people was the stuff that dealt with sex and violence, which, you know, the rappers would say, look, this is the culture of the streets. This is the culture of, you know, for NWA and Ice-T, this is the culture of Black Los Angeles. You know, you made it, and now we're reflecting it back to you. You know, and so there's no denying that a lot of the content on these albums is what you would maybe call like the disreputable pleasure, right? Which is the same kind of pleasure, don't get me wrong, that you're getting by watching kind of tawdry, you know, Amy Fisher stories, Joey Buttafuoco, kind of at the similar time on you know, the national news networks. And so So yes, a lot of this content is profoundly misogynist. It's sort of, you know, lashing out at perceived enemies, which, you know, are kind of street rivals, police, and, you know, women who don't know their proper place, according to a lot of them. And so a lot of that stuff is prevalent. But there's a what I would call a pedagogical aspect to this music too. There's so much to learn, you know, about Black popular culture and about Black history. I mean, you know, I write in the book a little bit about how, in the preface about how I learned that, you know, this was where I learned about, you know, hip hop records were where I learned about the Black Panthers. It was where I learned about who Marcus Garvey was. It made me, you know, I had to go to the library at the time and look up what COINTELPRO was, because I was, you know, hearing about this stuff on these albums. And so it was this, that was the other kind of part of this music, you know? So when you listen to, especially Ice Cube's solo albums, you listen to Public Enemy's albums, I mean, Public Enemy, this is, you know, one of the big reasons why Louis Farrakhan became such a prominent figure to a generation of young people was Chuck D from Public Enemy was putting him on Public Enemy records. And so, it was this sort of mixture of, you know, the kind of prurient content mixed with sort of righteous indignation and a little bit of history that none of us were getting in schools at the time, like far from it.
So it was keeping it real before these changes in education, where they're like, we're actually going to start teaching you guys what really happened.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Totally.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to the different roles that early 90s rap music played, what was it like for the Black community at that time? Was this a way to, again, get the voices out there?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm, of course, you know, full disclosure, you know, I'm speaking about this music as an eavesdropper. I grew up, you know, in the suburbs of Indianapolis, you know, in the 80s and 90s. And so I can't, you know, directly speak, you know, to the Black community's experience, but just reading, you know, writing this book, I was reading, I read all the biographies that are available about these rappers, and I kind of dove into the literature. And again, I do think that it served. I mean, it was a massive entertainment product. It kind of reorganized the music industry in a lot of important ways. But it was also an important network of information, especially for African Americans who were for decades shut out of major media coverage, who had problems with the police, who had problems with redlining, and you know, so many other economic problems that, you know, this was one pipeline. This was a way to kind of get their voices heard.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I do want to take a look at an example, or a listen, I should say, of a time when hip hop culture and reality TV came together in a literal sense. A panel of musicians and social commentators appeared in a 1990 episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show to talk about controversial lyrics and imagery in popular rap and punk music. You highlight this episode in your book, and we're going to listen to a couple of clips from the show. First, here's Juan Williams, writer for The Washington Post. Let's take a listen.
The way we do music today, especially with Walkmans, as you said, as you started the show, a lot of times parents aren't aware what the kids are listening to. The kids are listening, tuned into certain things, hearing these lyrics, responding to them, thinking of them as really anthems for their generation and their sort of rebellion, and tapping into all the hatred and resentments these kids have. And that's the way the music industry today seems to be feeding off of it, making money off of those instincts, rather than, if you think back to the 60s, the instincts about peace, love, and live together.
Eric, is this a common kind of commentary artists were getting at the time?
Yeah, I think, you know, Juan Williams was coming from a perspective when he was kind of looking at an era, you know, the late 60s, as I was kind of talking about earlier, when music was engaging with social realities in a way that was, you know, at times, you know, deeply resonant, but it was also kind of safe for airplay. And yeah, I mean, you know, if you grew up in the 60s and you were of a certain, I mean, by the way, all these rappers who I talk about in the book were either born in the 60s or very early 70s. And so these folks grew up kind of after the civil rights era in the 70s when things were a lot more muddled in terms of kind of, you know, where the where Black America was headed. And yeah, I mean, there's, you know, in a real sense, you know, you have somebody like Juan Williams, who's sort of a moderate political commentator, still around, who was at Fox News for a while. You know, of course, they're going to look at something like Ice-T. I mean, Ice-T had just released his album, The Iceberg, right before this episode aired. And oh, yeah, this was one of the most vulgar albums to ever see wide release. And so they dialed in not on the content, not on the kind of cultural context that kind of spurs this music, but they dialed in specifically just on like the bad words.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, another guest on this episode of Oprah was one of the originators of West Coast Gangsta Rap, Ice-T, as you mentioned. Here's what he had to say in response to Juan and to the critics of his lyrics. Let's take a listen.
Don, I don't have evil intent. I just make records in the format that, you know, me and my homeboys talk, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I mean, what I say on that record, what you heard, I didn't hear anything different than that in the movie Harlem Nights or anything. What I do is I bring out how brothers on the corner talk. Now, I might be wrong, but I can't talk any other way than I know how to talk. If I had to grow up like Brian Gumbel, I'd rap like Brian Gumbel.
So what does this argument from Ice-T tell us about the cultural dividing point you're looking into?
So I think that when you talk about, and Ice-T was really one of the earliest people, he's written about this several times, and he's written a couple books, and where he's a big proponent of the phrase reality rap. And he actually says he uses the phrase faction as well, too, to blend fact and fiction, which is a little bit harder to it's got some synonyms. But anyway, he is a big proponent of saying, look, there is as small of a barrier as possible between what I put on wax, what I am recording in the studio, and what I am either overhearing or talking about with my friends when we're hanging out. And this is really the same promise that is made by documentary filmmakers. This is the same promise that is made by the kind of local news outlets who say live, local, late breaking. And, you know, stands a reporter in front of, you know, some kind of event that's happening, is you're getting sort of the vox populi. You're getting the voice of the street, but not the voice of the street that the kind of mainstream news wants you to hear, but the voice that you're never going to hear unless you kind of take a trip to these neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting that he's mentioning that. And I'm surprised, like, this was from so long ago that they're speaking like this and come to today. And I feel like there's been a little bit more leeway in some of the lyrics and popular music and even movies and things like that. But Ice-T mentions a movie in that clip. And it's an argument that's often come up. Harsh language and imagery has long been accepted and even celebrated in movies, but is criticized when it shows up in music.
Right. Yeah. 1990 was a huge moment for this, too, which is when this episode aired. 1990 was the year that the MPAA changed the X rating to NC-17 because X was just, you know, impossible to release a movie. So NC-17 felt a little softer. So a lot of people were dealing with sort of the role of obscenity and vulgarity in American society at this moment. Some of your listeners may remember this was the big Robert Mapplethorpe moral panic. Robert Mapplethorpe was displaying some photographs at a gallery in Cincinnati, and that kind of erupted into this kind of moral panic about art and obscenity. This was the heyday of comedians like Andrew Dice Clay, you know, proudly vulgar, not censored at all to the extent that rappers were. You know, this was really the moment, you know, it was kind of America's existential foes had been vanquished, quote unquote, with the fall of communism. And it really felt for a whole decade that America was kind of turning on itself and fighting with itself, and vulgarity and obscenity and all of these moral panics really kind of rose to the forefront.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking now with social media and the internet, it's like anything is possible out there now. So it's hard to censor anything. Coming up after the break, we'll find out what impact climate change is having on Indiana and its industries. If you want to reach out to us, you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. It's the Friday Recap on All In. I'm Miriam Sob, and we'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. We're discussing the impact of climate change on Indiana and its industries. With us are Jeff Dukes, professor of forestry, natural resources, and biological sciences at Purdue and director of the Purdue Climate Change Research Center, and Lingxi Chenyang, environmental law fellow at Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Lingxi, you study a lot of laws and policies around agriculture in the country. Do we have laws in Indiana to help farmers, for example, when there are extreme weather events?
Yeah, so I think farmers generally are influenced the most, at least financially, by federal policies. So these come in the form of crop insurance and various farm payment programs, which help farmers bounce back financially after a tough year. Those policies tend to support cropping practices that are not resilient, like monoculture, corn, and soy cropping practices. I think at the state level laws generally have more influence over water management. So there was a bill that was passed this year, SB 389, that drastically reduces wetland protection in the state. So about 80% of wetlands in Indiana are state protected and 20% are federally protected. And the bill undid a lot of the protections for that 80%. And, you know, wetlands are, they serve a number of important environmental functions. So this bill was not great in terms of climate change because wetlands, scientists have found, are very carbon dense. They store carbon in the plants and soil, about 7 times more carbon than farmland soils. And so when you drain a wetland, those plants decompose and release carbon into the atmosphere. That bill is also not great for clean drinking water. Wetlands are connected to groundwater stores that we rely on for drinking water, and wetland plants help filter pollutants before they enter into those groundwater sources. And that bill is also not great for biodiversity. So wetlands serves important breeding grounds for many bird and animal species that matter a lot to, you know, our nature lovers and hunters. So that was a state level law that was passed that undid a lot of wetland protections.
And, you know, obviously that sounds like it's going to have an impact further down the line. Jeff, are you predicting that this will have a harmful effect?
Well, yeah, unfortunately. One of the challenges, as I mentioned before, with climate change, as we are experiencing it and expecting it to accelerate in Indiana, is this increase in precipitation in the winter and spring, and the heaviest rainfall events becoming heavier year round. And so another thing that wetlands do that's very helpful is they slow down the runoff of water into our ditches and creeks and rivers, and so they can they also allow more of that water to get absorbed into the land. And so if we're expecting to have heavier rainfall, the wetlands become all the more important for buffering our creeks and streams and rivers against flooding. And so having less wetland on the landscape means that we're likely to see those rivers rise faster and have more flooding challenges.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to Indiana not being prepared, Lingqi, does Indiana have any compare? I guess if you compare Indiana to other states and what they're doing for climate change, where do we stack up here?
So I think generally Indiana is a little bit behind on climate change policies compared to our neighbors. So as an example, Illinois, Michigan, and Kentucky have all released statewide climate recommendations or plans in the last 15 years. Indiana hasn't passed any climate-related legislation, although, you know, our cities, communities, and schools are picking up the slack. So about 15 cities, including where I live in Indianapolis, have some sort of climate action plan in place to reduce their carbon footprint and to deal with this hotter, wetter weather that we're going to see. On the other hand, there was a bill that was introduced this year that didn't make it through Congress, the state Congress, that would have been really helpful for our farmers. Basically asked the Department of Natural Resources to help farmers and forest land owners get money for storing carbon on their land. So as I mentioned, farmers can do this by planting fruit and nut trees and sometimes cover crops. And the way that the bill would do this is that, you know, major corporations like Apple want to become carbon neutral. And so they've basically pledged to offset a certain amount of carbon they can't cut from their own facilities by paying landowners elsewhere to reduce their carbon emissions. So that bill, if it had become law, would have helped farmers tap into this very lucrative carbon market. And that would have been really helpful, I think, for our smaller farmers whose bottom line is going to be hurt by, you know, these droughts and floods. So it's my hope that this bill gets reintroduced in the next session and gets passed.
Well, we have a listener voicemail from Lynn who has a comment about woods and large trees in Indiana. Let's take a listen.
This is Lynn Belena, and I live in the Yorktown general area, and I've seen a lot more wood being cut. I've lived in Indiana all my life, and everywhere I drive, there are woods that aren't there anymore. So I really think that we need to find a way to stop that if we're going to help with that. I agree with their variation in crop, which is one of my things I was wanting to say, and certainly I think we need to do that. So mainly I was concerned about the loss of our woods and our large trees. Thank you.
Jeff, so are we seeing a loss of trees throughout the state?
Well, we're seeing turnover in forest for sure. I'm not sure that we're seeing a big loss of woods on the whole if you look across everything. And there's one of the challenges is that there's value to lots of different types of habitats. So there's, in some cases, if you cut down a forest and allow it to regenerate, you'll have habitat that's really useful for some species that can't live in an older forest. But there's also a lot of value in having the old growth forest around, and a lot of people would like to see more of that. So I think the challenge for climate change is to look at this sort of holistically. Do you have enough different types of forest that are and different ages of forests that are providing habitat for the different species that you want to be supporting? And also, are you maintaining and increasing your overall carbon stock? Because the atmosphere doesn't really care about how much carbon is stored on any given patch of land. It cares how much carbon is stored on land in total around the globe and how much we're emitting, how much carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases we're emitting into it. So if we look as a state of Indiana, if we look across all our forests, what's going to be important is, you know, how much carbon total is stored in trees and in soils. And the program that would have been proposed or would have been put in place would have provided through this bill that Lingqi was talking about, that would have set up a market that would have allowed Indiana farmers and forest landholders to sort of sell into that, sell carbon offsets, carbon credits, into that market, to basically match them with different corporations more easily. There still may be something that happens next year, or this could happen on a national scale. There's a working group right now that the state has in place that the State Department of Agriculture and the Department of Natural Resources are organizing to look more in depth at this issue and how they would go about implementing something like this. So it's certainly not completely off the table yet, and this could get put in place in a variety of ways. But it is tricky. There are a lot of little issues to work out, and you want to be careful when you do something like that, that you're not essentially incentivizing, say, forest to be cut somewhere else when you're trying to incentivize carbon to be stored in one certain place on the landscape.
Well, Lingxi, when it comes to the carbon storage, I want to go back to that because I'm just trying to understand how would a farmer take part in a program where they're getting paid to store carbon?
Sure. So the farmer, given farmer can dedicate part of the land to planting nut trees or fruit trees, and they would essentially sign a contract where they would be obligated to keep and manage those trees on their land and sell those credits to, a given corporation that wants to buy those offsets. And to maintain the permanence of the carbon, to make sure that the carbon doesn't get released, that contract ensures that the farmer doesn't cut down those trees.
Mm. Well, couldn't a company also just plant a lot of trees around whatever new place they're building to help out with that, or put like a rooftop garden?
Yeah, definitely. So corporations can create their own offsets, and they can also pay landowners elsewhere to sequester carbon on their land. And I think the reason that corporations want to do the second thing is because, farmland just takes up so much land in the U.S. It's about 50% of the U.S. that's dedicated to farmland. So that's a lot of farmland that could be used to sequester carbon instead of producing fields and fields of crops that don't actually get fed to humans.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of crops not getting fed to humans, it makes me think of just the livestock and whether that's contributing to a lot of the problems we're seeing with methane and stuff. Jeff, is that a huge issue? Like, if we didn't have as much livestock, would that help our environment?
Well, yeah, I mean, it would. I think there's no getting around that. And there's a couple reasons. One is that the livestock, they can't help it when they're digesting stuff. They produce methane, so they'll eat, they'll graze or eat feed, whatever they eat. They essentially end up producing methane in their stomachs, and they end up burping up most of it into the atmosphere. And there are little tweaks that you can do to try to reduce that a bit. You can feed them certain seaweeds, and that can reduce some of the methane emissions. But you can't easily sprinkle seaweed out across the landscape when they're grazing, for instance, which is what they're doing for most of their life in many cases. And so there's challenges in figuring out sort of how do we implement these technologies that are just now emerging that might help us to combat that. The other way that livestock are contributing to climate change in a pretty big way is that in many parts of the country, or sorry, many parts of the world, less so in this country, but in many parts of the world, there is still forest being converted to rangeland, forests being cut down so that ranchers can graze their cattle over larger areas. And when those forests are cut down, of course, all the carbon that's stored in those trees goes back up to the atmosphere. Often the forests are burned, but one way or another, when the forest is turned into a rangeland, the tree, the carbon in the trees decomposes and starts contributing to climate change because less of it's stored on land. So livestock, I think in any given place, someone may have a livestock operation and may be doing everything that they can. They may to minimize the impact of it, including things like managing the effluent from the livestock operations, and because there's another source of methane and nitrous oxide emission potentially that's heating the planet. But if you look at it globally, it's really hard to manage this. There's this global demand. As we have greater and greater demand, essentially more and more forest gets cut down, and the more head of livestock you have around the world, the more methane is being produced. So it is a real challenge, and it does in the end come back to global meat consumption and sort of trends in personal preferences on that front.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about energy before we wrap up in a couple of moments. We have a question from Dean on Twitter who asks, are there any state or federal tax incentives for adding solar panels to your house, Lingxi?
I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. I have to dig it up a little bit. I do know that many churches have, I think, voluntarily put up solar panels on their rooftops. So about 50 churches around the state have done so. So I think a lot of homeowners and institutions are voluntarily doing these things, partly to save energy, but partly, I think, to show that climate change is really happening and to show that there's something that every one of us can do something about.
Mm-hmm. And are there policies towards solar energy at all that you're seeing?
I don't think anything was introduced this past year. And there might be something at the federal level, but I think not so much at the state level.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, what about your thoughts on the energy industry and climate change?
Yeah, I'd say if anything in the state, we've kind of been going the opposite direction in terms of policy. We've been the incentives for putting solar on houses and things have been getting phased out at an accelerating rate in recent years. And so so relative to other states, we have pretty few incentives for solar. There is a sort of a task force in the legislature that's looking at these issues right now and trying to figure out what our future energy mix should be and how we can put it on whatever the right course that they decide is. It's not totally clear what they're going to recommend and where that's going to go in the future. The one really encouraging thing, one of the really encouraging trends over the last decade plus is the rate at which the cost of solar energy and wind energy have been plummeting. It is so much cheaper now to install solar and wind than it used to be and to operate those. So now pretty much everywhere it's going to be cheaper to, well, not everywhere, but in many, many places, it's going to be cheaper to install a new solar plant and operate it, or a new wind operation and operate it, than it is going to be to run existing coal-fired power plants. You don't have to buy any fuel for solar plants or for wind farms. You can just let that natural energy flow, essentially. And so so it's now cost competitive to shift from coal to solar or shift from coal to wind. There are just challenges with the fact that the sun isn't always shining and the wind isn't always blowing. But the good news on that front is that battery costs are coming down too. We can put out now industrial scale batteries much, much more cheaply than we used to be able to. And so that helps somewhat with this challenge of intermittent or variable power coming from renewables. And as we increasingly upgrade our transmission infrastructure so that we can send energy from one place to another where this wind is blowing to where it's not, for instance, around the country, that's going to help a lot as well. So there are a lot of really promising changes happening on this front. We're seeing in northern Indiana really rapid rollouts of solar and wind by NIPSCO, the company that's responsible for a lot of the energy customers in the northern part of the state. And I think, it's pretty likely that going forward, we're going to see investments and policies that increasingly incentivize this, increasingly help us decarbonize our energy infrastructure and our energy supply. And that's going to go, a good chunk of the way towards helping with climate change. There's lots and lots of other things that we need to do too, but the energy industry is a huge player in this.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time to join us this afternoon. Jeff Dukes is a professor of forestry, natural resources, and biological sciences at Purdue University and the director of the Purdue Climate Change Research Center. And Lingxi Chenyang is an environmental law fellow at Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook. Book at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.